situations. The test applied is what use would an average owner make of the property, taking into account the geophysical nature of the land. Possession without hostility will not ripen into title. However, hostility is not used with the ordinary dictionary meaning of ill will, but the intention of claiming exclusive title and a denial of title in anyone else. The requirement of continuity does not require actual possession every single day of the period of limitation. Even if no evidence of hostile intent exists, there is a presumption of hostile possession where the property is used in a manner that the owner would use it. Two men, I am a realtor, and two men have come to my real estate office within the last couple of years, attempted to commit me to secrecy, and finally told me what their problem was. They wanted some advice from me on how they could adverse somebody and get a piece of property for nothing. I sort of looked at them. I says, what about the moral wrong and the technical right here? But that posed no problem for them. It made no difference. All they wanted was to know the method so they could get the piece of property for nothing. Mr. Average Citizen, who bought, paid for, and just got title to real property, cannot always discern the facts which form the basis for a cause of action. And we cannot properly allege that they knew or should have known. We must have legislation to improve this situation. And it is definitely in the best interest of the public that you pass House Bill 3195.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thanks very much for coming. Everett Cutter.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Everett Cutter, manager of the Oregon Railroad Association, and I would like to introduce to the committee Marv Fjordbeck, who is a Portland lawyer representing Southern Pacific Transportation Company and speaking for Oregon Railroad Association. He can answer questions you may have about the submitted amendments and about the other amendment that was alluded to.
Madam Chair, members, good evening. Southern Pacific and the Oregon Railroad Association put in the amendments that deal with the damages section 2 of House Bill 3195. We believed that if we were going to attempt to tighten adverse possession law in Oregon and also codify it, that it was appropriate to not require a trespasser to pay for rent, but that didn't mean that the trespasser should be insulated from either damaging the property that he is trespassing on or in depleting it. So our amendments go to Section 2 and delete Sections 2A and 2B so as not to insulate a trespasser from the situation in which he either removes crops or timber or damages the property with the advent of a toxic or some other substance. Oregon Railroad Association supports Section 1. I also believe from talking with Mr. Grant that the bar section, as he's already alluded to you, supports our amendment. As to the double or treble damages for timber trespass, those amendments are in the process of being prepared, and after consultation with Mr. Grant, I'm happy to submit them to you. I'm happy to attempt to answer questions.
Tell me what about, just to understand that we'll get them in writing,
What are the amendments likely to be with respect to Section 2 on the treble damages? Are you going to explicitly prohibit them or tell me where they will be directed?
Let me try to explain them to you. Yeah. Under current law, a person who is found to have intentionally depleted timber is subject to treble damages. Mr. Grant and I discussed this when we were talking about the Railroad Association amendments. We agreed that it didn't seem appropriate to doubly or rather to triple penalize someone, that the intent here was simply that if a trespasser depletes the property for some period with, again, an honest belief as to ownership, and that's found to be mistaken, he should make the property owner whole but not necessarily be penalized for it. That's the penalty provision is the purpose for the treble damages in our timber statutes. If these provisions were deleted, then the treble damage would still remain, and so we need a fix on the treble damage portion.
Great. Appreciate that, because this committee has some concern about adding to treble damages generally in the same way we have stacking up penalties, so we appreciate your sensitivity to that. And we'll look forward to your amendments. Anything else, Senator Springer?
Have you folks got a problem with people going on your property now and possessing it adversely and being successful in these claims and damaging your property and your assets?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, former is not necessarily, hasn't been my experience in 7 years of practice for Southern Pacific. The latter, which is individuals entering onto Southern Pacific's property, which varies in widths, for example, from 30 feet to as much as 500 feet, and believing for whatever reason that the property is theirs and depleting it, has from time to time been a problem. We have not had occasion to lose property under the adverse possession statutes. Part of the reason for that is simply that some of the right-of-way, because it was congressionally granted, is not subject to adverse possession.
Okay. Ev, could you give me a ballpark figure how many acres of land in Oregon are owned by your clients?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, I could not give you a ballpark figure out of the acreage. The track mileage is about 2,500 miles, and as Mr. Fjordbeck indicates, the right-of-way widths vary. There's also industrial development property and others not related to right-of-way.
Well, if you can find that out, I'm kind of curious.
I get the figure.
How much of that checkerboard that the government decided we'd give you folks back when you decided to construct all these railways? I understand that some of your clients are making a lot more money off of the property that we gave them than they ever will or ever did off of railroad operations, which is kind of a historical footnote, I guess. But
I'll provide that information, yes.
Okay, because I think you guys have a lot of property that's not strictly right away. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Brinson.
I'm going to be real brief because I see we have a big agenda. I want to make sure I understand how this is going to work. As a practical matter, it seems to me that somebody thinking of filing an adverse possession claim under this statute would be facing a double-edged sword, because I think you'd be awakening a sleeping dog, so to speak, in that if the other party knew that you were damaging their land, removing crops and trees and all that stuff, and knew they had a right to the property, they'd probably bring an action almost immediately. But they probably haven't. And so what we're talking about is this guy or this person for a number of years logs his land or whatever and then decides, hey, I better get this straightened out because I think I have a claim to title here. Thought I did all along, but my deed doesn't reflect that or whatever. Goes in and his lawyer would then have to advise him that if he loses this thing, he's now going to be, not only is he not going to get the land, he's going to be liable for damages to the land that he's done all the time that he thought he owned it, including removing the crops, trees, and all this other stuff. Is that what this would do?
Madam Chair, Senator Grinsky, That's the way the law currently operates now, so that an individual who damages a property or depletes it under current law is subject to the payment for depletion, to treble damages, and I might add is also subject to paying rent over that period under current law. You'll notice that we've left in what is now Section 2C because we believed that in tightening adverse possession law, it was equitable not to make that individual who had an honest belief as to the property pay rent. But that didn't mean that that person should put the actual property owner at a loss because of his mistake.
What about the statute of limitations, though? Generally, that's going to be 2 years in these cases, and adverse possession isn't established for at least 10 years under the common law. So as a practical matter, these actions would never occur in a counterclaim in an adverse possession case. Now, how is this going to be affected by this statute?
There would be a, if there were continuing depletion, as is often the case, then they, that depletion would continue.
Okay. That'd be the only time, though. If it had ended, that'd be it for you.
Additionally, in the matter of that's correct, Senator. And as a matter of waste on the property, for instance, the introduction of a hazardous substance, that of course is an ongoing problem.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll look forward. Any questions?
I'm not sure that I have questions of these witnesses, but I apologize for being. I couldn't come here earlier. I have handled a number of adverse possession cases over the years. I guess I'm curious.
Not to change, this is to codify the common law, quotes and quotes.
This is not intended to work any change in the common law?
Except for what you just heard.
Well, I wasn't really listening. I was trying to get caught up by reading the bill.
Well, perhaps Mr. Grant can,
I hope I
can assist us.
Okay, I'd say, I guess I'd ask Senator Shoemaker or Mr. Grant, if you'd give Senator Shoemaker a call, we'd appreciate it. We would not have to.
Yeah, let me tell you what my concerns are. I mean, adverse possession is a rule of law that has been developed over many, many, many years throughout this country and in England. I mean, it has a very established meaning that's been developed in case after case after case, and all of a sudden move in and codify that adverse possession. I mean, it is already in the law, I understand that, but I mean to put a statutory gloss on it is very troubling to me as to why we really need to do that. I guess that's what I need to be persuaded. Why do we need to tamper with the way this law of adverse possession has developed? That's my question. Maybe you should answer me directly. And where is the Oregon State Bar on this?
That's who he is who testified in favor of it. And I'll have him call you. Okay. We really don't have time today. If you get in touch with Senator Shoemaker, we appreciate that. And he has been off, not on his own. He's been off with other chores, so it's not as if he hasn't
been. Judiciary
committee. Right. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, let's... let's take care of Jack's bills and start down the list on 2188. We have Terry Floyd from the Oregon Fire Marshals Association. And I'd ask witnesses to be quick in getting up here and sitting down. And the next bill we will have will be House Bill 2214.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Terry Glocker Floyd, and I'm here to present testimony on House Bill 2188 on behalf of the Oregon Fire Marshals Association. Len Monquist had a conflict tonight and couldn't be here. The Oregon Fire Marshals Association would like to offer an amendment to House Bill 2188 for your consideration. The proposed amendment is amend Section 1 to add a new subsection G. The manufacture of any pyrotechnic device containing two or more grains of pyrotechnic charge in violation of Chapter 40, Title 18 of the United States Code. This amendment is offered because Oregon has experienced a rapid growth in the manufacture and sales of fireworks, large firecrackers such as M-80s, M-100s, M-500s, and M-1000s. These pyrotechnic devices are illegal to manufacture by federal laws, but not Oregon laws. The federal attorney is so overloaded that he's unwilling to prosecute these manufacturers. We would like to have the option of prosecuting under state law, and this amendment will give us that option. The manufacture of these devices is a serious fire and explosion hazard. Many lives have been lost, and serious property damage has resulted from operations elsewhere in the United States. During the past 3 years, the Oregon Fire Service has uncovered numerous manufacturing sites. Just last year, the Gresham Fire Department arrested an individual who was manufacturing M3500s. This device was 4.5 inches long and 2.5 inches in diameter. Experts stated the device contained 96 times the pyrotechnic charge of an M80. If Oregon does not criminalize the manufacture of these devices, then sooner or later we are going to have a serious fire and explosion, possibly involving deaths. The Oregon Fire Marshals Association urges your support of our amendment. If you have any questions.
Chair.
Thank you, Jack.
Is the intent of your amendment to just prohibit the manufacturer, or is it to prohibit the possession as well?
Yeah.
Because it looks like you're amending the section that has to do with possession. I don't.
Okay, that's a question that I can't answer, but okay. Len Momquist will be in legislative session tomorrow morning, and he indicated he'd be happy to address questions that you might have.
Fine, we'll work on the amendments and see where they might fit and what the intention is, whether it's possession and manufacture. Thank you.
Okay.
Are there any other questions?
It's just a question. Yeah. These M3500s, isn't that the little of a stick of dynamite?
That's one of the things that I checked with Mr. Momquist today, and he indicated that was approximately half a stick of dynamite. An M3500 is about the size of, a little bit bigger than a can of Campbell's soup, a little bit taller than that, and just a little bit bigger around.
That's incredible. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Jack?
Does your amendment, does an M80 contain two or more grains of charge?
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Is anyone here from the state police? You want to come up and testify about the bill, since it's at your request? Why do you need it, and why do you want it? And maybe you want the right person. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is John O'Neill. I'm the Oregon State Police bomb technician. I've been working with this bill from its inception. I can't address the amendment as offered.
Yeah, we're not talking about the amendment. I'd like to have you talk about the original bill for a minute or two.
In the original bill, at this time, we have a problem in this state where a person can actually walk down the street carrying a bomb comprised of, for instance, a length of pipe capped full of black powder, smokeless powder, with a fuse extending from it, in one hand and flipping a big cigarette lighter in the other hand, and really the only violation we have under existing law is possession of a firework. For a number of years, had a problem with this because I'm the one that many times has to take these items apart, whether they are the pipe bomb or the more sophisticated devices. What this bill does is bring Oregon law in line with existing federal law and make possession of these type of destructive devices illegal.
Thank you. Are there
any questions? I'm sure I have an observation to make. In Section 2 of the law, of the bill, it's says a person commits the crime of unlawful manufacture of a destructive device. The person assembles, produces, or otherwise manufactures a destructive device is defined in Section 1 of this Act. Section 1 of this Act does not define a destructive device. It merely says what it does not include.
Well, isn't bomb, grenade, rocket?
Nope. It's not.
If they possess?
Yeah, but it says, it doesn't define it, though. It says they're in unlawful possession of a destructive device if the person possesses. I suppose that's what that's intended to mean, but I don't think...
Well, we'll have Jack check that out then, to see whether it's we just refer to those items or wristband or however we get...
I think that's just a drafting thing, but I just noticed that it didn't seem to track.
I'm assuming we're talking about all those other...
It's a good bill.
First lines 7 through 18, or 17, talk about what it does mean, and 18 talks about what it doesn't mean. So we'll have Jack check that out. Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much. Okay, let's move to 2214. We have David Masters from the Department of Corrections, 2214.
Madam Chairman, I'm David Marsters. I'm an instructor at Oregon State Correctional Institution, and I'm a registered lobbyist for the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to answer any questions that you might have about 2214.
Tell us what the bill does and why you want it. I assume it has to do with education for...
It does. House Bill 2214 allows the continuation of the Joint Planning and Development Team. This team already exists and is a functioning part of the Department of Corrections. This also continues a relationship with the State Department of Education Office of Community Colleges and with contracted institutions, Chemeketa Community College, Blue Mountain Community College, Western Oregon State College, and the Vocational Training Apprenticeship Council through meetings of this team. House Bill 2214 also establishes corrections education, the position of corrections education director as chairman of the team. This new position solves the current problem of a rotating chairmanship, which places documentation of meetings, actions, etc., in different offices with different people. This will also facilitate communication and activities with community colleges and the State Department of Education staff. Section 3 of the bill also addresses the need for a functional literacy program in the Department of Corrections and establishes how that program is to be set up and administered. At the present time, our relationship with the State Department of Education is loose. And the State Department of Education and Corrections would like to see this relationship tightened. We would also like to see a leadership position established with one individual who can coordinate all of the programs at present operating individually at Oregon State Penitentiary, at the Correctional Institution, at the Women's Center, and so forth.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Sounds like a good move to me. Senator Springer.
Real quickly, can you tell me, in each of the state corrections institutions, do we have an educational or literacy program at this time?
We do, yes. There is a literacy program at Oregon State Correctional Institution, at the penitentiary, a rudimentary one at the Women's Center and a rudimentary one at the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution.
How about at the new minimums that are being designed?
No.
Is there any reason we don't anticipate an educational program at the new minimums?
Well, tell you the truth, I'm not real sure why that is the case. I believe that if we had a director of correctional education in the Dome Building, that when the planning process was proceeding, that there would be a voice for education and it would be included in the planning. And I think at the current time, that's one of our problems, that the planning goes ahead and they're concerned about security and they're concerned about space and beds and so forth, and they forget about programming.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Excuse me, can I ask one question? Is this in the budget? This personnel slide in the budget?
That was my question.
Yes, it is. It's in the governor's budget.
I don't think that means it's in the budget. Yeah.
Right. It's probably in the side budget. That's okay. I'm curious as to what.
The fiscal impact is one position with one FTE for the biennium, $133,000. And that's, my note shows here, the Crime Fighting Program Agency, 29900, package 408, $66,500 general fund, $66,500 other funds.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that we'll have some increased activity from community colleges through our lottery workforce dollars if they'll be out giving you some program dollars, we hope. Thank you.
That'd be very nice.
Okay, there's no one else signed up on 2214. Let's move to 2257. And we have John Pinkstaff from the Oregon State Bar is here and Steve Anderson from Defense Attorneys. Why don't you both come on up, please? 2257.
Okay, I'm John Pinkstaff with the Oregon State Bar's Committee on Indigent Defense. Just to keep it brief, the Bureau of Justice Systems department out of the Department of Justice conducted an EMT group study of the impact of prosecutorial practices and included in their recommendations was a finding that an interview of the officers by the prosecutors, interviewing these officers in person before issuing a charge, gave a more complete screening at an earlier stage in the process and would result in an earlier dismissal and a reduction in the volume of cases without jeopardizing the constitutional right of counsel. And they also cited in that group study the Spangenberg report, which I'm sure you're probably all aware of. That's all I have to say on that. I think it's pretty well documented that this is a cost-saving device without any real jeopardy to the right of counsel or, as a matter of fact, to the important aspects of law enforcement.
Thank you. Steve.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Steve Anderson, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I would simply want to put us on record as in favor of this bill. I would characterize it as a housekeeping money-saving measure, and if it will help unclog the system and perhaps move things along faster, it seems like a good idea.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, did the District Attorneys Association take a position on this bill?
I don't think officially they have. We have had district attorneys, individuals, say that they have no problem with this. In fact, many district attorneys I practice in the Yamhill County area, for instance, some in Polk County, Washington County, many of the prosecutors already do this. I don't think it's really asking for much of a change. It's just simply to make it uniform throughout the state.
So they do not oppose it?
I'm not aware of any strong opposition to this. from the individuals I've spoken with. I don't know about the association.
John, what was the vote out of the House?
I don't know that. Maybe
Jack can probably look up. No.
I have the committee vote, Madam Chair. It was 12-0. I don't have the floor. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Senator Springer?
Should we consider expanding this to those jurisdictions where we've got a fairly active municipal court, require the city attorney to review citations before they are filed in municipal court? Eugene, Salem have pretty active municipal courts. I mean, I realize indigent defense is their problem in that situation, but did you folks give that any thought?
We didn't really, our committee did not consider that, I believe probably because the funding from the state is different for municipal courts than for the district or circuit courts.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, both of you. There's no one else signed up. Let's move then to House Bill 2262. You are the same. I better look ahead here. Something else.
I thought you'd gotten rid of us. But.
Right.
Well, except that's pretty expensive. I mean, some mayors may be, the chances of their taking are pretty remote. And I wonder if we shouldn't give the court discretion to not require the agreement from all heirs. And that's, if the court's judgment is not practical to obtain that permission and he doesn't think it's a significant risk.
Well, I suggest you talk to the sponsor about that and see what they're willing to do. I suppose the Oregon State Bar stepped away from this because they thought it didn't do that much, didn't step away that far from current practice. So I guess that we'd have to ask the question of Representative Vaughn and have him go back and visit again with the bar to find out what it would mean.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker and the committee. I try to answer questions, but I'm not really familiar with this as I'm reading it into the record.
Oh, I understood that.
I could find out or have the representative speak with you if that'd
okay,
be preferable.
Maybe you have him ask me about it.
Yeah, I'm frankly one wouldn't want to move too far away from the requirement of a bond just on the face of it. But I'm happy to have people look at it and see if you wanted it moved in that
direction. Well, I think it's a good bill. I just think that maybe they built something into it that is going to make it hard to use in case it should be available.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll note that. Okay, we have 20. Let's get to the
Oops, sorry.
Some questions still. Craig Edwards is here from the debtor creditor section, and Gene Grant is here from the real estate section. And I guess, Gene, for the moment, we're talking about 2279 and 2280. If you'd identify which bills you are going to comment about, that would be useful, and then we'll move on to the others. So that would be helpful. Craig, why don't you comment first?
That's great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to address both bills, 2279 and 2280, which are companion measures as they wind their way through the legislature. I'm here at the request of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar, which has some concerns about House Bill 2280. I was asked to present those concerns to the real estate and land use section of the bar, and in a phone conversation this morning with Chris Gorsuch, I learned at that time that there was a hearing set before the committee this afternoon or this evening, and I have not had an opportunity to speak formally with the members of the real estate and land use section. I would ask that on behalf of the debtor-creditor section that this committee take no action in regard to either of these bills presently until we've had a chance to discuss the concerns that the debtor-creditor section has, in particular with House Bill 2280. I've spoken with Gene Grant outside the committee room here today and have told him the concerns of the debtor-creditor section. And again, I'm prepared to talk further with all the members of the committee that are present with Chris Gorsuch. And speaking with Chris this morning, he had no objection to what I then characterized as a request for a postponement of any action by this committee. And he's not here tonight. I tried to get a hold of him at 5:35 this evening to let him know that the committee, in fact, was going to hear a testimony on the bill this evening. I'm glad that Gene is here on behalf of the real estate and land use section. I'd be happy to address what our specific concerns are in connection with the bill, but I'm not sure that we have to get into that right now if the committee would allow us the time to discuss the differences that we have.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I had just a couple of things for the record. This bill was provided to the debtor-creditor section of the bar.
Okay, now are you speaking of 2279?
I'm sorry, both bills, okay. 2279 and 2280, which are companion bills, were both provided to the debtor-creditor section of the bar approximately 6 months prior to the beginning of this legislative session. And we proceeded with the pre-filing of those bills with the understanding that we had the blessing of their section. And I think it's probably a fair characterization that what we're dealing with here are second thoughts. The real estate section put a fair amount of effort into these two bills and believe that they address a serious defect created by the decision in the Chiappuzio case, and that we need to have that corrected. And my only concern is that a postponement not result in the these two bills not getting out of the legislature, not being enacted at all. If it's possible to postpone it without jeopardizing the bills, I have no objection. But if the real estate and land use section, of course, wouldn't have submitted these bills unless they felt that it properly and appropriately corrected the problem created by that case.
Okay. I was asked to sort of hold up the bills, and I wanted to at least make sure that we had. Say that I guess I'd ask that if you think that your comments are going to materially change the bills, we'll reschedule them when you've had a chance to visit and see if you can come to any agreement. I would ask if you're willing to go through the bills if it doesn't take too long, at least give us a sense of what your section wanted to accomplish by the two bills, so that the committee has an idea of what we're trying to do. With that in mind, we will put the amendments that are offered at some later date into context. So if you would take a few minutes now to explain 2279, okay. 2280, the purposes, that will help us, I think, as a committee to get a leg up, if you will, when we come back to dealing with amendments.
Okay. The Chiappuzio case involved a situation of a security interest in the vendor's interest on a land sale contract. So you have three parties: the debtor who owes the money on the land sale contract, the purchaser of the property who owes the money, the seller on the land sale contract who has the right to receive the payments, and then a third party who took a security interest from the seller, saying that to the seller, if you default on your obligation to me, I will have a right to take the payments that you will receive from the purchaser as my collateral.
And the question before the court was whether that security interest represents a real property interest or a personal property interest, and as a result, whether you have to be governed by the laws under the Uniform Commercial Code on perfecting security interest in personal property, as opposed to perfecting a security interest under the real property law using a mortgage or a trust deed, for example. And the decision of the court basically said you can do it either way, the corollary of that is if you are involved in a transaction with real property of this sort, it means that to find out if there is such a security interest, you have to search both the UCC records and the real property records to determine if there's a security interest on this contract. So the problem created is that it's a trap for unwary lawyers. If they only check in one of these two sources, they're liable to miss security interest filed in the other location. And it also created some uncertainty as to what substantive law governs your remedies. And so the intent of these bills is to come down clearly on the side of saying a security interest in the seller's interest on a land sale contract is an interest in real property. If you want such a security interest, you take a mortgage or a trust deed on that interest. You record it in the real property records, and you would be governed by the substantive law of real property.
So you're
moving
into real property
interest
rather than the commercial code at this point.
Right. That's right.
Anything? What else does 2279 do?
I believe that's basically it. Okay. At least as far as our intent, that's we believe that's all it does.
Great. And 2280.
The 2280 amends the UCC provisions.
Right.
2279 amends the real property provisions.
Senator Hill.
What is the bar's internal mechanism for avoiding these kinds of...
The procedure is that you, you submit these bills before the session to the Public Affairs Committee, and so that the overall bar organization can decide if there's a conflict. We also submit them to the bar lobbyists who play the role somewhat of an umpire, and or at least someone, they'll try and get the different sections together. And then we also provide these bills to the executive committees of the different sections that we think might have an interest in it. And of course, the debtor-creditor section and the real property and land use section very often have an interest in each other's bills. And over the approximately 7 years that I've been involved in this work, it has always been a struggle to avoid these kind of situations. And that explains my obvious frustration that after 7 years, we still haven't figured out how to do it. We're trying.
You are doing better this year.
Thank you.
in spite of tonight, but I really want to say you are doing better.
Thank you very much.
Anything else? My question to Craig would be, is there any middle, is this just one or the other, or are we going to feedback making that kind of a choice?
I think that Gene properly characterized the problem, and I would just say that I know of no problem with the concept of having one place for perfecting a security interest covering the seller's interest in a land sale contract. If that choice is to perfect these security interests by filing or by recording in the deed records of the county where the property is located, that does not present a problem. The problem that we will work on is whether or not Article 9 should be deleted entirely from application to a seller's interest in the land sale contract. And there's a question as to what other jurisdictions have, the way that other jurisdictions have characterized the seller's interest in a land sale contract when mortgaged. And I at this point would say that there is not a problem with House Bill 2279. It is the House Bill 2280 which would delete the applicability of Article 9 and the consequential.
Thank you for your comments, and it's just to give a committee some idea of what the range of debate or discussion is likely to be, so we have an idea of that.
Right. Common ground is in the area of perfection. Whether or not Article 9 should be deleted is the area that we need to examine.
Thank you. Other questions?
I'd like to have real briefly.
Senator Gretzky.
Just because you guys aren't here every day, you might be interested to know that I think the bar is the only organization that comes in with people opposed on each side of an issue on the same bill.
Have a schizoid personality,
every
I guess.
Committee I sit on, and for everyone that's ever testified, this is at least the second time I've seen it, perhaps the third.
That's okay.
Just a little commentary I thought you might be interested in.
Right. Well, at least we're trying to present all sides of the picture.
We want the best bill that we can get out, and it's the only way to get it.
Madam Chairman, if we could, just very briefly, I think we could finish House Bill 2281, which
yes,
I'm also here
I
to cover.
Yes, I do have it. I have you right here.
Thank you.
2281
involves real property tax foreclosures, and it was submitted because some counties were interpreting the existing law such as to not require them to provide notice to lien holders who would have a right to redeem the property after a property tax foreclosure. They were relying upon a very literal reading of the old provision, which said that the they would have to give notice to a person that had a lien or interest in the property that then appears in the records of the county. And the problem is when it says then, it means after the tax foreclosure has occurred. And so the counties took the position that since the liens had been foreclosed by the property tax proceedings, they no longer were an interest of record and no notice was required. It's kind of standing the notice concept on its head. So we've redrafted that provision to make it explicit that the counties must notify any person who is entitled to redeem the property under the redemption statute and whose interests were in the record as of the date the foreclosure proceedings were instituted, as opposed to after the foreclosure proceedings have been completed. So it's really in the nature of a technical correction to avoid a misreading of the intent of the law by a few counties.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's move to 2275. One more. Come on.
We're going to come up together. We're
good. Same bill. Madam. This is our last bill, folks, at least I think.
Good evening. Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Robert Erickson. I'm a private lawyer in Portland, partner in a firm, Martin Bischoff, Kevin Erickson, Langslet, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. The background, a little bit, I was past chair of the Oregon State Bar Uniform State Laws Committee, and this bill we have, House Bill 2275, was presented to our committee at that time. It was a few years ago, and it's been working through committees for quite some time. The bill involves the Personal Property Leasing Act, and effectively what it does is quite a substantive bill, as you can obviously tell. What it tries to do is follow quite a bit the format of Article 2, which is quite familiar to most lawyers and industry people, on sales, and make changes as necessary to apply to leases, and in particular to a part of the leasing industry which has grown up called the finance lease. And the finance lease, just for definition purposes or for general illustrative purposes, is the following. Instead of the buyer of a vehicle or a heavy equipment or aircraft or whatever going down to its bank and borrowing the money and then going out and buying the item, the buyer effectively selects, let's say, a Boeing aircraft and has the bank buy the Boeing aircraft and then lease it to the buyer, and that becomes a finance lease. Well, obviously, under that sort of a three-party situation, where the economic realities are such that the bank, the lessor, the owner, is really more of a financing arm, the same obligations of implied warranties and so on wouldn't necessarily make the same similar sense they would in a true sale. And so this act, among other things, attempts to deal with those sorts of problems. It also, as a part of the not housekeeping, but a part of the overall provisions that the uniform state laws, national actually, commissioners on state uniform state laws came about, they took a look at the security interest definition, which is found in the definitional section of all of our uniform commercial code in Oregon and most states, and made some modification to that provision, the security interest provision, made it clearer, effectively. There's been a lot of litigation about what a security interest is, and tried to help a little bit on the parameters there. As you might imagine, with a bill of this nature, it has gone through a number of revisions in the national level, and then getting to the states. We have done, in the committee level, I can attest that we have done a lot of work on it, and it's had a lot of work done through the House sessions to get it to the House. I just came in out of town, and I was just told before arriving here that, I'm satisfied where it is right now, but I was just told just before walking in this evening that Mr. Romaine has one modification, and it's dealing on Section 34, page 12, or proposed modification, actually. Section 2 in line 14, where there's the words by the existing lessee, he wants to add right after that word of that lessor. And this particular provision is a what may be called an entrustment situation. And under the present Article 2 in sales, the general situation is, let's, for example, A buys a car from dealer A, and then and financing it, for example, and what goes to dealer B and entrusts the car for some reason, and dealer B sells it a second time to a bona fide purchaser. The law in Article 2 would protect that bona fide purchaser and let that person take free of any prior existing sale in this instance. This the Uniform Act attempted to keep that same provision for leases, and I quite frankly think it is a good idea. And this act here also maintains it, as it passed the House, maintains that for protection for the bona fide purchaser, subsequent bona fide lessee, with the exception, and this was found in Section 3, which is following right there, Section 34, subsection 3, and that's the instance where, for example, a car which is subject to a certificate of title, the notion is, for example, how can subsequent lessee take free of a titled vehicle, because obviously it's titled, you'd be able to notice, and that you're not going to be bona fide. So you're really not changing the normal bona fide rules we have in common law and grafted in Article 2. Passed the House, it would remain similar, in my opinion, to Article 2 and just apply to leases. And I think I told you where we stand on this. I did comment to Mr. Romaine that if the committee wishes for us to discuss it further, I would certainly be happy to discuss it with him and whoever else wants to make some changes, but that's my position at this point.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I represent the National Vehicle Leasing Association, and no, I'm not here to add wine coolers to this.
Just territories.
This late in the evening, I don't know how you keep anything straight, but we do the provision that Mr. Erickson was talking about in line 14 of page 12, section 34. Is a concern of the National Vehicle Leasing Association and also the Oregon Bankers Association. They have joined us on this request. In the House, we went through numerous amendments of this provision, of this act, and we agreed on everything except for Section 34, and what we did was agree to look at it again. We basically got worn out and wanted to get the bill through the House. We came back over here. My instructions today from the National Vehicle Leasing Association were that they thought they had an agreement early on with another person who was here in Mr. Erickson's absence on this particular provision. What we have agreed to do is go back and see if we can look at this again and see if we can come to some agreement and bring it to you on this one particular provision. It's the only provision of the bill that we have any problem with at all. Basically, what it does is, if our amendment would say that if I'm leasing a car to Mr. Erickson, and then he gives it back to me, entrusted back to me, and I lease it to somebody else, then that person takes free of our lease interest. But if I lease a car to Mr. Erickson, and then he gives it to another person, entrusts it to another person, and that other person then leases it, then that other person takes subject to the lease that I had with Mr. Erickson. That's our conflict right now. My suggestion
to you is... Where do you want to stop it or begin it? What's the difference? Tell it to me just where the difference is. Where do you want? I gather you want to stop it at the second person? Or you want the interest to continue forever and you want to stop it at some point?
I want to allow a bona fide purchaser or bona fide lessee to take free and not be
encumbered by
some prior thing. In fact, the car instance, if you may, Paul, is maybe an incorrect instance because right. The car is covered by Section 3, which is a title right. Vehicle. Let's say it's an airplane.
In airplanes, Paul, if you're here on the National Car Leasing people?
It's vehicle leasing. It's a number of different things that are included, that some of which I believe are not titled. Our contention.
Am I just dense?
Our contention, Madam Chair, is that once
I
you went.
I wanted to answer that last question.
Yeah. I think I got the answer from Mr. Erickson. You don't want the final person who's in possession of the property, having leased it from somebody, to have
be encumbered by his prior leases, for example, if it's a bona fide situation. And the only in the car instance, probably it's never going to be a bona fide situation because it's a title right. Situation because they know about it.
And then Paul's position would be that if somebody's in the middle, they should still have an interest over the person who finally ends up with the lease.
Right. Madam Chair, what you've done is if I've leased it to you, basically, if you go along with Mr. Erickson's plan, you allow that person basically to transfer the rights that I have. And we have a problem with that. Now, again, we thought we had some kind of agreement on this. This is not a work session, and hopefully by the time you do bring this up.
I know, but the committee has some right to make a decision which direction they'd like to go on it, too.
I realize.
And it's important for us to understand that because, it's nice to have everybody come to agreement and compromise. You know, there may be some consumer interests here that we all would like to think about and at least be aware of.
Madam Chair, again, what we would like to do is go back, see if we can work it out among ourselves, and then have the committee make a determination if they want to go along with us or not or whatever. But you basically won't have any controversy if we can just sit down.
Senator Wrensky, we've never been afraid of controversy.
No, we embrace controversy around here. I just have one really quick one, and I'm just skimming this whole thing, but a subsequent lessee, are they going to have an ability to determine if, in fact, this is encumbered by another lease somewhere? Is this going to be filed? No? You're shaking your head no?
Oh, excuse me. I was thinking that if it was titled, they would, and that's what they would.
Let's assume it's not titled, because then it's going to be covered by another section.
I don't think they would have a difficult time.
Well, in that case, it seems to me he's got a real good argument for this bona fide purchaser thing, because in the other cases, there's always a way. The person may not explore the way, but there always is a way to find out if it's encumbered. And that's why they take it subject to the security interest or the claims of the prior owner or whatever. But in the case where a lessee takes this thing and has no ability to look backwards and determine whether or not there is another lease on this thing, it seems to me they should be entitled to take it free and clear.
That's what
Which is your position,
That's our
right?
my position. Oh, you're looking...
I was looking at him, but I was meaning your position, yeah.
I agree.
I was hoping you were just confused.
Well, I'm confused as well. That's overall. That's an umbrella problem. But I do think that's a fundamental problem that you're going to have to get over, I would think, is that the
you
fact that they...
You meaning Paul and me.
These two, somehow. Yeah. If they're going to try to work together, is that I think he's got to...
Madam Chair, Senator Wrensky, we are in support of the bill. It's a good bill. It's a good bill with either one. We think it's better the other way, but either way, whichever policy decision you come up with, you should pass the bill. It's a good bill.
I'm sure comments?
I added all kinds of clarification to this situation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And there is no one else, and we are adjourned.
You threw me off balance with that, Dad. Excuse me.
Thank you.